Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I welcome our audience live here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Dulé Ray, who is going to be speaking tonight on, or this afternoon, I should say, on, it was 50 years ago today, about the Beatles' first concert here at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. For those of you who don't get the reference, it was 50 years ago today. Okay, how many understand where that comes from? Yeah, I thought so. Okay, almost everybody. Great. Great title. When I heard the title, I said, got to have that lecture. So just one thing, one question before we start. So everybody who's, you know, of a certain age here in the audience is completely aware of that the 50th anniversary of 1967, the Summer of Love, is also coming up. How many know where the term flower power came from? What's the origin of flower power? Does anybody know that? So it just came, and of course that was the big thing for the Summer of Love, flower power, and those images of, you know, people protesting the Vietnam War and taking flowers and putting them into the gun barrels and everything, very, very powerful images, you know, for those of us of a certain age. but anyway, flower power comes, actually, it is connected to the Beatles because the teacher, the guru of the Beatles, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi that he studied with, this was before the Beatles were involved, but he would walk around, when he spoke, he would go around and he would hand out flowers to people, and they would give him flowers. That was the way that they greeted each other. And so that flower, the flower power, that's where that came from, and that's why I've had one chance to wear this tie in 30 years. So, without further ado, Dulé Ray and the Beatles.
Thank you, George, and thank you, people of the Commonwealth Club, for inviting me here today. It is indeed 50 years ago that the Beatles played at the Cow Palace, and you probably know that it was 50 years ago today is a paraphrase of the first line of a well-known Beatles song. Here's another paraphrase line for you. I hope you will enjoy the show. You will have seen from my info there that I'm somewhat of a musician, sometimes I'm asked by musicologists, you know, why this interest in pop music? You know, why this interest in the Beatles? To which I say, why not? If you can write 200 excellent pop songs and they're still popular in 50 years' time, I will speak about you. Latin was mentioned earlier, and I went to a grammar school. There were no girls. Right? The teachers were masters, and I did Latin in school. But my music teacher was so ahead of his time. He was really avant-garde in all senses. And he was interested in the music that we listened to as young adults. And he was a classically trained musician. He liked jazz, which is quite wow for us in the mid-60s in Little Old Wales. And what he would do, he would ask us, what's number one in the top 10, boys? Beatles, sir. Bring it in. We'll have a listen. So we would bring in the little vinyl, right? Put it on the record player. Yes, any explaining needed? I should have mentioned my music teacher's name, a man called Gerwin Thomas. And he would then follow the song with an analysis of the song. And he would talk to us boys about, you know, the vocal structures, the chords, the harmonies, the lyrics, and especially the hook. And today, I'm not going to talk a lot about the formation of the Beatles as such, because this is so well documented. But for you that don't know, that's where Liverpool is, up there in the top right. I don't remember the name of the country, but the country to the left is Wales. And then the country to the left of that is Ireland. And the Irish were just Welsh that could swim, of course. Down the bottom left, if you see Carmarthen, that's where I was born. And so in this school, this music teacher would analyze Beatles songs, nothing to do with the music curriculum as such. And he was also interested in how the Beatles formed. And in the late 1950s, early 60s, Liverpool looked a lot like this. And some people say it hasn't changed that much. But in the late 1950s in Liverpool, of course, people like John Lennon and Paul McCartney, they all formed their own little bands, which had ever-changing personnel. And there's a very famous slide of the Quarrymen, which was the Beatles' sort of first incarnation with John Lennon front and center. They then changed the name to the Silver Beatles and eventually became the Beatles. And they made their name, of course, at the Cavern Club in Liverpool, and eventually settled down to that combination. Ringo Starr replaced Pete Best, who was the first drummer of the Beatles. What do the Beatles play in the famous Cavern Club? Not the songs we are familiar with today, not their old compositions, not yet. What they sang were covers of American rock and roll numbers, such as Long Tall Sally, Matchbox, Gene Vincent's Bebopper Lula, To Know Him's To Love Him, Money, That's What I Want, Kansas City, Red Sails in the Sunset, Besame Mucho, Falling in Love Again, right? All these great classics. These songs are, of course, covered by dozens of other performers as well. There's the Cavern Club. And it wasn't until about 1963 with Twist and Shout that the Beatles began to become really well known in the pop world. And Twist and Shout, which I thought as a kid was a Beatles original, was actually a cover of another song, of the same song, rather, recorded by the Isley Brothers in 1962. And in the world of musical composition, to have originality early on in a career is very rare. And unlike other songs of that era, Beatles songs are still popular today. And among their earliest original compositions is the song Please Please Me of 1962. And if you notice the title, the play on words on the title, that is typical of John Lennon because he was also a poet. And by the way, the date of a song, such as 1962, is not always a reliable reminder of the actual date of composition. For example, another 1962 song, Love Me Do, was actually written in 1958 by Paul and John, Cutting School. I never did that. I Follow the Sun, 1964, was written when Paul was 14. When I'm 64, actually composed when he was 16. So the date of the song is not always reliable. The vast majority of songs, around 85%, were written by Lennon and McCartney, which is the most commonly known combination. But there were actually six combinations within the band of who wrote what. For example, She Loves You was written 50% by John Lennon and 50% by Paul McCartney. Michelle and We Can Work It Out, the verse section was written by Paul McCartney, and the middle eight by John Lennon. Please excuse the jargon. They were also practical composers in that they wrote, they knew what they were writing for. They wanted Ringo Starr to sing on every album. And Ringo Starr has a very attractive voice, but it's quite limited in range. It doesn't go very high, doesn't go very low. So those songs are quite easy for everybody else to sing because you don't need to go very high and very low. So that's just an example of how practical the Beatles were as well as composers. All right, now it's quiz time, folks. Who wrote these songs? All right. It gets harder down the bottom. Okay. Easy one. Yesterday. Oh. Correct. Right. Revolution? John. Good. Helter Skelter? Paul. All right. It's a surprise sometimes. She's Leaving Home? Good. All right. Come and Get It? Less answers coming. Instant Karma? John. Yes. Cold Turkey? John. Right. OU? Yeah. Well done, Paul. All right. So there is a bit of a clue in the title of the song. A bit of a clue. Not much. John Lennon's titles and lyrics tend to be more rebellious, psychedelic, forceful, surreal, whatever you want to call it. And Paul McCartney's tend to be more lyrical, romantic, childlike, sentimental. But the division is not always that clear. Lennon and McCartney, as well as being composers, were great lyricists as well, which is not something you can say of today's lyrics in certain so-called. Moving on. I will leave my comments on Rolling Stones up there. All right. So if you look at the lyrics on the screen, there's an example of a comparison between McCartney and Lennon. And John Lennon, as well as being a skillful lyricist, as I mentioned, he was also a poet. He was also a cartoonist and an artist. For example, he published a book in 1965 called A Spaniard in the Works. Again, notice the play on words in the title. In the song Please Please Me, unlike many conventional pop songs of that time, the final verse repeats the words of a previous verse. Why? It doesn't really matter, but it's often a conscious decision by the lyricist to repeat a verse. Sometimes it enhances the progression of the story during the song. So the order of verses and choruses will vary from song to song, although there is a standard form, which I shall show you in a minute. There's one Beatles song, by the way, which is just one verse repeated three times. Maybe. Yes, that's one line. Do you want to know a secret? All right, it's all right. Okay. Same verse three times, but preceded by what we call a recitative. Introduction. Can you think of any other songs that have a slow introduction where it's sung rather freely? Misery, yeah? Rocky Raccoon, yes. I haven't got that down. We'll have it for next time. Right, Honey Pie. Here, Then, Everywhere, which we'll hear, right? And famous examples. And although the majority of Beatles songs and lyrics are familiar to us of a certain age, some phrases have become obsolete. What do you think of these? We'll skip the first one because it's too easy. Right, what was a man? A raincoat, yes. In what song? Thank you. All right, For a Fish, same song. All right, it was a measure of fish in the fish and chip shop. 10 Bob Note, thank you. All right, it was a currency, it was a 10 shilling bill. News of the World, maybe, yes, I got Polythene Pam as well, so they're right, okay. Do you know what it was? My parents used to buy this every Sunday, I'm so ashamed. It was a dreadful, gossipy newspaper, right, which they used to sneak, pretend not to read. Mr. Wilson and Mr. Heath. Taxman. Yeah, taxmen. They were opposing prime ministers in the 1960s. BOAC. Back in the US. Right. What was BOAC? Yeah, the preceder of British Airways. Matt Busby. Dig it. Thank you. Excellent. Right, Dig It. Okay, Matt Busby was some kind of a soccer coach for England. I'm a rugby man. I wouldn't know the difference. There we go. Right. Are all Beatles songs unique? Is it possible to be totally unique in the world of arts? All right, very difficult. And sometimes the Beatles copied another style, and this is called a pastiche. So if we listen to, say, Obladi Oblada, right, I'd like you to tell me at the end what influences the song. What's the pastiche of? What's the style? I mentioned that in a bit. Caribbean, Jamaican, all right, yeah, so, you know, it's a great pastiche. And if you pretend that back in my school, my teacher would play that song and probably comment on the risque lyrics, he would also, in particular, focus on the form of a song, on the structure of a song. And in music, we often use letters to describe structure. I'm sure you all know Norse Galan. Now do you know Norse Galan? There we go, right. Now, let's not sing it, but... if we call the first line of lyrics A, the second line repeats, let's call it A again. The third line of music is different, let's call it B, and the fourth line more or less repeats the first line. So A, A, B, A is a very common form in all kinds of music, not just pop music. And if you substitute verse for A and substitute chorus for B, then it begins to turn into a pop song. And there is a thing called sort of standard pop song form in world, which looks like that. And as you're figuring it out, let's have a listen to Here, There, and Everywhere, because it almost fits this structure. This is a bit of a template, but not many Beatles songs actually fit this template. Everyone is slightly different, which makes them great songs. Did you notice a slight variation? Anybody? Not that it matters. It's just a beautiful song, you know. Instead of this second chorus, there's another verse that comes back, right? But it's irrelevant. Historically, the better composers, they're not straitjacketed by templates with form and structure. For example, Beethoven. Right? So to composers like that, it's the sound of the music that's more important than conforming to any structural convention. And with Beatles songs, the later songs are even more experimental. Some of them have very short verses, very long choruses. Some have no choruses at all. Some have very strange structures that almost don't fit any form at all. I'm going to give you one example, which is called Ask Me Why. And again, just listen to the song. It's far more important than if it fits the structure. But that's the best I could come up with trying to explain the form of this gem of a number. If repetition in music creates form, and there's no repetition, then what do? Right? I'm going to show you a term I learned from my music teacher in school, which I've never forgotten. Durch Komponiert. This was in the context of Schubert songs, but it's a term you can apply to some certain Beatles songs, such as Happiness is a Warm Gun, because it almost doesn't repeat any sections at all. It's kind of weird, isn't it? There we go. Here's a question. How many of the Beatles could write or read music? Give me a number between -1 and 1. You must have gone to my school. 0. None of the Beatles could read or write music. All right. So how did they write down their music? They had the help of this great guy, George Martin. Sometimes called the fifth Beatle, which is a term he doesn't like, by the way. But he is a classically trained musician who worked mostly in the pop industry, for the BBC in particular. And interestingly enough, his social background was the total opposite of the Beatles in all respects. But they worked so well together in the studio. When you have somebody like George Martin who can write out bits of music for you, that's called an amanuensis. More jargon, sorry. A classic example of George Martin's contribution to the Beatles is Penny Lane, because Paul McCartney had heard a high trumpet in some Bach music, and he wanted this effect in the middle of Penny Lane, as you probably know. But he couldn't write it down. He could whistle it, or he could hum it, but he couldn't write it down. So that's where George Martin stepped in and wrote it out for the trumpeter. And nobody's going home today without hearing something from this album. All right, thank you. No need to name the famous people, all right? Why is this album so important? Why is it so historic? The adjectives go on forever. But it is the result of extended studio work. So why did the Beatles change from being a live touring band, to the isolation of a recording studio? Well, if you were at Candlestick Park in 1966, you would know why. Because the Beatles at that time were at the end of their tether. They'd been touring continuously, punishing schedules, 14 major cities, coast to coast, in about 20 days, 2 shows a day. Sometimes, like in Cincinnati, there was no stage canopy and it rained. Not good for the electric guitars. So the Beatles decided, George Harrison, I won't do the accent, said, we knew that we were no longer going to do this again. We were no longer on the buzz of fame and success. It had enough, basically, by the 29th of August, 1966, at Candlestick Park. And I didn't go to the Paul McCartney concert before you asked. maybe you were there in 1966? Thank you, dear. My favorite wife. But only 50% of the stadium was sold, and the Beatles only played for 35 minutes, if they could be heard at all. All right, it's famous, isn't it? So after a break, they decided to go to the studio back in London and create a new album based on childhood experiences in Liverpool. And Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever were the first 2 tracks more or less completed. And EMI put pressure on George Martin to release these 2 tracks as a AA single. Whereas George Martin wanted to keep the 2 tracks for Sgt. Pepper, which never appeared on the famous playlist, of course. And another thing that makes Sgt. Pepper even more amazing is the fact that it was all recorded on 4-track reel-to-reel tape recorders. Today, they have computers in the studio, right, that can record one single solitary sound. But in those days, they had 4-track reel-to-reel. So how is it done? Sorry for the cutoff, but That album still sells millions today. What more can you say? What's the legacy of the Beatles today, 50 years on and more? I mean, the facts and the trivia speak for themselves, obviously. But remember, they only wrote around 200 songs. Only around 200 songs, which is a relatively small amount compared to some composers that crank them out, okay? How many number one hits did they have? 27, which is pretty amazing, all right? And bear in mind that these songs, they don't rely on today's flashy pop videos, the sensational, nonsense I call it, that comes with today's pop music. It's purely about the music and nothing else. I'd like to end with a cartoon, which I'm sure you'll appreciate.
Can you read it? We can't see it from
back. Can somebody read it? I don't actually. Nice and loud. All together now. I'll leave it up there for you to see, all right? Okay. Yes. Anyway. I'm sometimes asked as well, how long will Beatles songs remain popular? Well, I mean, 50 years is not a bad start, is it? You know, and the best art, the best quality art, stands the test of time and stands repetition. So that, I rest my case. And thank you so much for listening. And if you have any questions, I'll take a couple. Nothing too complicated, please. Thank you, George.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that they're listening to Blair Reese speaking about, it was 50 years ago today when the Beatles first came to the Cow Palace in the San Francisco area. And we'll take questions. And if you have a question, you can either line up over here or over at this mic.
Lady Madonna. Like my children, you know, I like them all. So, but one of my favorites.
Which one was that?
Lady Madonna, the one I played at the beginning. So.
Thank you so much. I'm a huge Beatles fan. Have you ever seen them live, or Paul McCartney, or any of them? And also, what kind of are you a classical musician, and do you
afraid so.
Conduct as well?
Yes, I am a classically trained musician for my sins. I never saw the Beatles live. My wife did. Or you saw them, but you never heard them. Right? I was asked this at the beginning. I didn't go to see Paul McCartney at Candlestick. I prefer to remember the Beatles as they were. And I'm afraid I would be disappointed. And I would be comparing. I know I wouldn't be, but I would be afraid I would be comparing one member only, sadly, of the four still remaining, with my childhood memories of them. So that's my reason why. It's a pretty pathetic reason, but it's the best I could think of.
If you ever have a chance to see McCartney, I'm sure you're not going to be disappointed.
I know. I acknowledge all that, yes. Everybody tells me, but I'm still thinking about it. Hello.
Thank you for the presentation. Thank you. Question. You covered the earlier part of the Beatles more than the latter part. What about Abbey Road, and how would you say the songs on Abbey Road, especially as George Harrison comes into writing his songs and having them published on Abbey Road? Do you have any comments about the formats
Absolutely.
Of the songs? Or, you know, especially there's a sort of a stark contrast between Abbey Road, the very last album, versus Let It Be. And, of course, you didn't touch too much about the White Album.
Time constriction is the answer. But I actually have a section in the lecture about joined-up songs. And if you listen to Abbey Road, the second side, you have seven joined-up songs. And the it's a wonderful piece of what would it be? You know, it's called segue in music. You cannot hear the join because they're just seven separate songs. So my preferred side of the album is the second side. And it's only time that precludes me from speaking at length about the White Album in particular, because it's a double album. And we have number 1 to 100. You have something valuable in your closet, apparently. So. But George Harrison's contribution, of course, is sort of underestimated. And again, if I had more time, I would have mentioned more about him as well.
We get the joke there, but I always thought that John Lennon wrote those words, and he was literally screaming out for help at a time that was very difficult.
Yeah, it's right? It's deceptive sometimes who actually wrote the song. It's for example, Helter Skelter, which is such a heavy rock number, I assumed was more John Lennon, but it was actually Paul McCartney. So it's very difficult to tell who wrote what sometimes, even with lyrics. It's the actual melding of composer and lyricist has always been a mystery. And one of these things you have to sort of speak to the actual people involved.
I think one of the things that I find fascinating is when you watch the movie Let It Be and you realize the disintegration that they were going through, Let It Be, while it was the last album released, it was not the last album recorded. So Abbey Road was actually recorded after Let It Be, and the juxtaposition of watching them in the movie and how dysfunctional they were, followed up by, I know, my favorite album by anybody ever. Mm. It's just unbelievable what they were able to summon to be able to create that masterpiece after, you know, what they were going through.
Yes, I totally agree. I think Let It Be was an album that was sort of put together by Phil Spector. Am I right? Yes. Mm-hmm. And it was very controversial. And the actual final album was Abbey Road, and fittingly ends with the song The End. At the end of the second side, which has always struck me as very poignant. I don't like to watch the Let It Be video. It's too distressing. I'm a purist. I'm sorry, there was somebody over there, maybe? Oh.
Okay. If you look back over the Beatles albums, John Lennon is always listed first under the songwriters and Paul McCartney second. Is there a reason for that?
I think they fought over it, if I remember rightly. It was going to be McCartney and Lennon, but it didn't. Was there a trip off the tongue, right? So, but there was a little bit of, with regards to, but anyway, it was very minor.
On that same subject, Paul has wanted to have Yesterday. You just have him listed as the only songwriter for the Yesterday song, and as you know. Yesterday has over something like 1,500 recorded cover versions, one of the most recorded songs of all time. What's your opinion about Paul's efforts to have him just have his name for the song Yesterday?
I think it was a financial decision at the time. it's to do with royalties and the legal situation. I mean, nowadays, of course, it would be a different thing. But in those relatively early days, I think for whatever legal advice they received, they decided to let's put both names and we get double royalties. I don't know. But it was, some songs are purely by one composer or the other, but listed as joint. It must be a legal thing. And they also sort of lost control of the copyright later on, and so it's kind of complicated. So,
many of the albums that were released in America had different song lineups than the British releases. So I was wondering if you knew the reason for that.
Yeah, and different covers as well. I mean, different pictures on the covers as well. It was to do with the duo release of the albums. I don't know a lot about it. I mean, people, you know, they go to conventions to discuss this stuff, right? I mean, that's not me, all right? What you say is true. But the reason why, I don't really know the reason why, I'm afraid. But again, it's probably legal or something.
Yeah, on the co-write, yes, it is a legal thing, but my understanding is they agreed going in as writing partners that they would share all co-writes equally, regardless of who did what. Otherwise, it becomes 15% of this song is mine. You know, it becomes a big wrangling over
exactly.
That. So that was an agreement they had going in. Likewise, George was given songs later because the other two Beatles weren't getting the songwriting royalties. They were only getting royalties off the sale of records. So they were losing a big income stream.
And bear in mind that Lennon McCartney were writing songs when they were still in school, 14, 15, going back a long, long way. So it's a partnership for sure.
Time for more questions.
Okay. Mark Lewisohn wrote a new book called Tune In. It's a big anthology of the first couple of years. What have you read it, and what do you think about Mark Lewisohn's huge project to document the Beatles?
Haven't read it yet. Sorry. I actually have. May I mention one book? Alan Williams, who was the first Beatles manager ever in Liverpool in the 1960-61. He came to Bangor, where I went to university in North Wales, and it was a Sunday afternoon, nothing to do, and he was talking about, I gave the Beatles away. I thought, oh, I'll go, you know, what the heck. So I went, and it was so interesting, and it was fascinating, and I actually bought a copy of his book, and he signed it to me. Ooh. So that's the only connection I have, you know, with books that are of any value, but I've read lots of books, and I find they tend to repeat a lot of the stuff, but this new book sounds more in depth for sure.
Did you ever meet Brian Epstein?
Meet him?
Yes.
Good Lord, no. I don't move in those circles. No. I would have liked to. Yeah. His influence on the Beatles was huge. He made them wear suits, for example, instead of scruffy leather. He made them bow at the end of songs. His influence, he made the group more professional. So I would have commended him for that, for sure.
I very much love Eleanor Rigby. To me, it's like a beautiful classical piece, and like Harrison's While My Guitar Gently Weeps, mm-hmm. I was wondering what your feeling is about those songs, and also I can't think of any other composers, pop composers, where every album is like a whole different feel and a whole different type of music. It's absolutely amazing.
Exactly. I think you're talking about the range of music that they produced, the variety of styles that they utilized. It's all there, from romantic ballads, irrespective of the composer, to heavy rock numbers. And the variety, to me, just reflects their talent as musicians, as a band. So I totally agree.
Do you have a favorite? John versus Paul versus George?
Oh, no. No. I remain neutered.
So I think maybe one or two more questions are possible if anybody has them, but I think it's one of the things that's interesting is their personalities are all so strong, all four of them, and how maybe you could comment a little bit about how their personalities, it's not it's just their music, but I think a lot of people of their voices almost as friends. You know, it's almost like not the music, it's like you hear this
friend's voice. Yeah, well, it's to do with Liverpool. Built by the Welsh, occupied by the Irish. Right? It's true, right? It's to do with their background. And if you research their childhoods, they had tough upbringings, and having to play in Hamburg for hours and hours on end at the Star Club in Hamburg. They had a baptism of fire as young musicians, and we tend to forget how young they were at the time, early 20s of age. And so it's very interesting, and their personalities obviously were very important, and they were individuals but also formed this wonderful group.
I had heard that Brian Epstein was responsible for bringing Ringo into the band. Is that the truth?
Apparently so, yes. Pete Best was an adequate drummer, but Ringo Starr was, I think he was playing with Rory in the Hurricanes, am I right, at the time? And he was kind of drafted in, and Rory Best was booted out. That's happened at those days, and Ringo Starr is a phenomenal, solid, in-the-groove drummer. He's not flashy like some drummers, but he's just so solid, and he was brought in for that reason, I think.
Related to that, at the ASCAP special that aired earlier this year, Ringo talked about the first session with George Martin, and George had hired another drummer because he didn't know that Ringo was on the job.
Oh.
And he still apologizes to him.
Really? Yeah. What a great guy. Yeah. I would like to have met George Martin because his contribution was again, phenomenal. and I have great respect for him. And he actually has released an album called In My Life, which are his cover versions of famous Beatles songs, sung by famous people, friends of his, name-dropping kind of thing. But it's a great album. All covers of Beatles songs, can't go wrong.
What did you think of In My Life with George Martin playing the harp, the piano, and then sped it up? You know how he created that harpsichord
effect? The little link thing, yeah. That was an accident, wasn't it? It was kind of, he was messing around when they were on lunch, and when they came back, they said, oh, we like that, we'll have it in. So that's sort of typical.
Is there any reason you didn't include the Casbah? You know, they played a lot at the Casbah Club, the Beatles.
The where?
The Casbah.
The Casbah Club.
You know, the
in Hamburg?
No, in London. I mean, sorry, Liverpool.
Liverpool, oh,
yeah.
Right.
Just Derby. West Derby.
So, yeah, we mostly connect them with the Cavern Club, but there were other venues as well, of course.
Yeah, they started there.
Yeah.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.